Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening, it's 7 o'clock on Friday and you're listening to Little Atoms. My name's Padraig Reedy and I'm hosting the show with Neil Denny, who will introduce this week's guest, Ian Sample.
Ian Sample is an award-winning science correspondent at The Guardian. He was named Investigative Journalist of the Year in 2005 by the Association of British Science Writers. He was previously a feature writer for The New Scientist and holds a PhD in biomedical science from Queen Mary, University of London. Ian's first book is Massive, The Hunt for the God Particle, and we'll be talking about that tonight. Ian, welcome to Little Atoms.
It's really good to be here.
First of all, what we should do is, before we get into the meat of the hunt for the God Particle, let's have a quick recap of how we got to the standard model of particle physics.
Well, this was just the result of many decades of work looking at particles coming in from cosmic rays and such like, and basically just drilling down on particles even coming from radioactive sources and trying to find out what the fundamental building blocks of nature were. And this started off with, obviously, the electron was in there, which were discovered in cathode ray beams. And basically, over decades from the early sort of 20th century, really coming on through, a lot of fundamental particles were discovered. We had quarks late on, electrons, and basically what the standard model does was in the 1970s, it started coming together as a complete package of equations which describe the fundamental particles being things like quarks, electrons, and their other generations. There are heavier versions of electrons and such like this, and also particles which carry forces. So the photon is in there, which carries the electromagnetic force or light, and there are other particles in there known as W and Z bosons, which are two particles which carry the weak force, which goes to work in certain radioactive materials, and it also plays a role in allowing the sun to shine at the sort of rate it does. So the standard model was this very nice picture, almost a very complete picture, that shows how particles behave, the very fundamental building blocks of particles, how they behave, and the forces that they use to interact with each other, all except gravity, is not included in that.
The other concept, which I don't think we've ever really talked about on the programme before, we've talked about the particle physics a few times, but you introduced a concept of fields, which is, you know, vitally important to the subject matter of the book. So let's talk about that. Well, what do we mean when you say a field?
Well, this was something that really, I mean, you could say it began with people like Faraday, but it was I think it was really Maxwell who James Clerk Maxwell who really encouraged physicists to take this idea incredibly seriously. I mean, the idea was being used, but he used it in a very beautiful way. And what Maxwell did was show that, basically, by working through the mathematics of how electricity and magnetism worked, he showed, without intending to show, that electricity and magnetism were not only linked, but they were actually waves in an electromagnetic field. And what was nice about this was, going back way before this, there was a feeling that forces, say gravity, that they act at this distance, they act instantaneously, which is strange because they must move through something. A force must move through something. And a field really says, OK, there is a field that takes a different value, an energy field, if you like, that takes a different value from one place to another as a force is transmitted. And one thing that Peter Higgs got involved with was something called quantum field theory, which is pretty central to the standard model. And this is basically an idea of saying, OK, you have almost all the particles we can think of have associated energy fields, and each of those fields can be quantized. So you can say there is a particle of energy in each of those fields. Now, a really easy example is one I mentioned earlier. Light it's carried by particles of called photons. Those photons are quanta of energy of the electromagnetic field. So you can actually transfer that to all particles and all fields, and with that describe the different forces and the different particles that exist in the Standard Model.
You mentioned Peter Higgs there, and I think most of us, you know, all listeners would be familiar, all listeners to anything would be familiar with the phrase Higgs boson, but I don't know who Peter Higgs actually is or why he's got this named after him.
Well, I mean, how far back do you want to go? I mean, Peter Higgs is, I think he has a very interesting history. He was sort of brought up and dragged around the country during the sort of run-up and during the Second World War. His father worked for the BBC in an area called Balance and Control, which was just starting up, which was basically trying to make music sound realistic over the airwaves. Spoken word was pretty good, music was pretty dreadful, and there was a booming business at this time. This was like, you know, the late 19... I mean, Higgs was born in 1929. It was during that time that radio was really booming. So Peter Higgs, born in Newcastle, taken to Birmingham, aged one, moved down to Bristol just after it had its heart bombed out in 1941 after the Good Friday bombings. When he got to Bristol, the family moved around because of the father's job, Thomas Higgs's job, and he had to get moved yet again because nowhere really was safe, and the BBC relocated people up to Bedford, leaving Higgs really to be brought up by his mother alone in Bristol. What was interesting that happened in Bristol was, coming back to one of your previous guests, Graham Farmelow, is that Higgs went to what by that time was called Cotton Grammar School, and he used to stand around at the back of the assembly, look on the walls, and on the walls there was a big sort of area which had the names of the very famous alumni of the school, and one of those people was Paul Dirac, and he thought, who is this sort of interesting guy with all these middle names, and who is it here? And he appeared more than once on that list, and Higgs got interested in Paul Dirac, who was actually a contemporary of his father's at Bristol University studying engineering. Higgs found school, he was good, he was very good, he got prizes in everything bar physics. And what he really says is that a lot of the teachers were off at the war, they didn't have the highest caliber people that were still around, and also the classes were just uninspiring. He used to go and find books and read up on other stuff, you know, the amount of extracurricular stuff. And he seemed to carry this habit through university as well. The amount of extracurricular stuff he did, reading up on physics and getting involved with it as a sheer passion. And, you know, Dirac was always there as someone he was interested in, drove him to become this interesting physicist. And also an absolutely not an experimentalist. I mean, he did try doing experiments and failed. I mean, he recalled a number of attempts to do experiments to me, and they weren't a pretty sight, and he just decided it. Theory is the thing for me. He was incredibly good at mathematics and pushed on in that way.
There's a really lovely story where he takes an exam in theory. He's the first person to take an exam in theoretical physics at his school.
That's right. Well, this is actually when Higgs goes on to university. Now, the family gets reunited in London after the war, and Higgs decides that he, very understandably, wants to do his university degree in London because the family is at last together. You don't really want to go and go off to another city to do this. He also had a real dislike for Oxford and Cambridge. He thought they were places where the sort of children of the idle rich went to waste their time and the time of their tutors. So at King's College, which is where he ended up being accepted, he tried UCL, they didn't get back to him. He did excel at theory. He became student president of the Maxwell Society, interestingly enough. Maxwell is a theme throughout this book, really. But he was the first person in the college to do a theoretical option. Now, what happened is that they didn't have theoretical physicists, professors at King's at that point. The year he was there, theoretical physicists was taken on. So then you have this problem. What do we set this guy as a final year exam? Because all the other guys who are doing experiments, they have to do an exam. Why shouldn't Peter Higgs? He's the only one. So what they do is they look through the literature. They find a paper that's recently come out. And it's a paper where a very smart physicist has solved a very arcane problem. So they think, I know, we'll rephrase it and set it for Higgs as his final year exam, one of his final year exams. Lo and behold, the paper comes in, and Higgs actually has not only solved it, but solved it in a more elegant way than the original physicist achieved it. And it's he's very sort of dismissive of this, and it was told to me, the story was told to me by a good colleague of his who is now a professor in the US, and it really sort of set the bar high for that college for the rest of sort of the students coming after him.
So let's move on to the thing that Peter Higgs is famous for then, the Higgs field and the Higgs boson. Well, I suppose we should really talk about what is the problem that he was trying to solve? What are these, what are these things? What do they do?
So there's an interesting thing. We were talking about the Standard Model earlier, and if you look at the kind of how the mass falls out of the Standard Model, the particles, it works if all the particles are massless, basically. And this basically suggests that these particles, early on in the universe, they were massless, which means if a particle is massless, it moves around at the speed of light. Now, so you're faced with a problem. We know they have mass. You know, these particles, you can capture them. You know that they have mass. And so there was a problem in physics at the time of working out, well, how do we generate mass for these particles? And in Peter Higgs went up to Edinburgh University in 1960. Now, he had been trying to sort of go various places. He did the postgrad circuit for quite a while. Turned up at Edinburgh University, was kind of doing okay, but not really making huge headway in what he was trying to do. 1964, there was an argument going on in some physics journals, and it was arcane, but it was about people were arguing about whether certain theoretical arguments could be used that have been developed for superconductors, actually, whether they could be transferred to say this is how particles get mass. Now, that might seem a really bizarre connection, but bear in mind that superconductors were being studied to the hilt at the time. They were these incredibly promising materials that you can run electricity through with no resistance, and that had sort of all sorts of fabulous prospects. The theory behind it, though, there is something very interesting going on inside a superconductor, which is, inside a superconductor, a photon gets heavy. So if a photon enters in, it slows down. And this is akin to it gaining mass. And so this led to some ideas as to go, well, maybe there are some particles that became massive because of some kind of effect similar to a superconductor, and other particles that didn't, i.e. the photon. Now, how to work this out was very tricky. And the guy who was really driving the field was a guy called Yuichiro Nambu, who at the time was at Chicago. Now, what Higgs did was weigh into this argument, essentially, and say, look, there is a way this can be done. And he wrote off one paper in the summer of 1964, 79 lines long. He just sent off a quick letter to a journal based at CERN. The editor was based at CERN and said, I think I know a way of doing this. He then had a sort of a strange experience where he had promised to go camping the following weekend. So he dutifully did this. He had married and dutifully decided to go off to a place on the west coast of Scotland, which had been recommended by a joint friend of the couples. And they said, look, you must go off and have you're going camping, go to this wonderful place on the west coast of Scotland because it's apparently has the least rainfall in Scotland. And they trooped off there, and lo and behold, they get there. It's gales, it's tipping down with rain, and they give up trying to put the tent up. They just go and retire off to a little village, find a B&B, and it's kind of a bit of a blessing in a way because Peter says the next day, look, we're going back, cracks back to Edinburgh, and gets on with working on his next paper, which is actually the most important one. Well, the most important one of 1964, at least. In the meantime, they find out that their friend had read this article wrong, suggesting the place in Western Scotland was the driest in the country. It's actually the wettest in the country, but she'd misread it. Anyway, they get back to Scotland, and Peter Higgs writes up another paper, really laying out how a theory, which is very similar to what goes on in superconductors, could give particles mass. He sends it off to the same journal at CERN, who, lo and behold, reject it. A letter comes back with his article saying, very interesting, we can't see how it has any relevance to particle physics. He is appalled, but examines what he's done and thinks he probably hasn't sold it very well, which is very true. And he has two paragraphs to that paper and decides to send it off, not to the CERN journal, but to its competitor, to an American journal called Physics Review Letters. And he does that. Now, the penultimate paragraph of that paper is the paragraph that draws attention to the fact that if his theory is right, if this field exists, which gives mass to particles, then there will be a new particle to look for. And it became known as the Higgs boson. He calls it a scalar boson in the article. But it is that is the first mention that there is a signature particle you can look for. And if you find that, then the Higgs field is right.
So before we go into the second half, just there's an analogy for the Higgs field, which I think was by John Ellis, which is of the snow field. Would you just tell us what that is? Because it really does make it quite clear.
There are all sorts of analogies for the Higgs field, but the one that John Ellis at CERN, he's in the theory group at CERN, tells is by far my favourite. And I was asking him to describe it to me when I was there one day, and he said, look, imagine an infinite snow field. So you look out the window, and it had been snowing around CERN that day. And you imagine snow going on forever, but you somehow have to imagine it being 3D and infinite. Not too easy. He said, there are some particles that will shoot over this as if they have skis on. So like a photon will be a particle with skis on. It will glide over the top and hurtle along. Now, there are other particles that act as if they have snowshoes on. So these might be they have mass, but they're not very heavy particles. And they kind of trudge along, they go fairly slow through this field. So they get quite stuck in it. But then there are other particles yet, which are basically barefoot, and they trudge through it knee-deep in snow. And these are particles like the top quark, which is really the heaviest fundamental particle there is. And it's what he's getting at is that the field is, depending on how you interact with the field, that sets your mass. There are some particles that interact with a lot, some particles interact with it a little. And a snowflake is the Higgs boson in this analogy.
You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Padraig Reedy, Neil Denny, and our guest, Ian Sample. So, Ian, we've established what Higgs boson might be and the importance thereof. But how do we find it? What are we looking for? What would signify this great potential discovery?
Can I say one more thing before we go on to that? And I will come on to it. I'm not avoiding it at all. But there is a real misconception about what the Higgs field is and, more importantly, what it does. And people think the Higgs field gives mass to all particles and they think it is responsible for all mass of everything. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's really badly wrong. The situation is very different. Say I weigh, 80 kilos or something like that. Roughly about less than a kilo of my body weight is thanks to the Higgs field. So about 1%, okay, of any object, your cat, your mobile phone, that is due to the Higgs field. It's due to the energy of the Higgs field from the fundamental particles interacting with it. Almost all mass comes from quarks and gluons, which are the particles that bind them together inside subatomic particles called protons and neutrons. The mass comes from quarks moving around and being bound together by these other fields.
I think there's a figure, is it a quark is 400,000 times heavier than an electron or something?
Yeah, and it's something like that. And but you have to think, when you bind these things together, a proton will have three quarks in it. If you add the weight of all the quarks up together, you only get like less than 1% of the actual weight of the proton. So you think, well, where is it coming from? And it's from this energy. And it's, you know, at the end of the day, you could say the mass of all of these things comes from energy, but it comes from different places. And I think that's just an important thing I wanted to make sure was that we weren't saying that the Higgs field gives you mass for everything. Remind me of your question again.
Where is it?
Well, the question is, you know, we've established that we need to find this thing. Yeah. How do we find it? What are we looking for?
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, when Higgs came up with this, there was a whole tranche of work that went on, which slowly showed that the Higgs idea, the Higgs mechanism, was probably right, because people found that it was important in separating two forces in the early universe, electromagnetic force from the weak force. So there is indirect evidence that comes out that there is something like the Higgs mechanism going on, because you need it to separate these forces, and we know they are separate. And it does that by making some particles heavy and leaving other particles alone, like the photon. Now, how do you find it? The ironic thing about the Higgs boson, which we all know is so intricately linked to mass, is that the theory doesn't predict it's the mass of the Higgs boson itself. So you don't know where to look for it. And the way a lot of modern particle physics works is that you use a damn great big collider, you smash particles together to generate energy in a very small focus, and that energy condenses into particles. Now, if you don't know what kind of mass your particle is. You don't know what energy the particles need to be hitting together at to see them. You don't really know where to look for it in your detectors, because it's much easier if you think, I'm looking for something of such and such a mass, let's collide these particles at this energy, and we know that when we reach enough energy to produce the particle, it'll probably pop out. Mm-hmm. The tough thing with the Higgs is we don't know where it is. So what you have to do is basically look everywhere. It's like sort of chucking your keys blindly into your house, and then you have to search every room for them, because you know it's in there somewhere, mm-hmm. and something, the Higgs or something like it, has to exist, but you just don't know. You know within a very broad range where it is. You have to just eat away at those masses and look and look and look and look until hopefully one day you find it.
One of the methods of searching for it that everyone will be familiar with is the particle accelerator, and we've watched the rise of the Large Hadron Collider recently. But going on from what you've just said, there's a really great illustration in the talk of the Trivial Piece, and when he's trying to sell the superconducting super collider to Ronald Reagan, and he gives a description of the guns in the haystack.
That's right. So, just to give a little bit of background to this, is that in the late 70s, through the 70s and the 80s, CERN is doing, and Europe are doing very well with their particle accelerators. CERN ends up finding an effect which is very indirect evidence of Higgs. I mean, it's probably even too strong to say that, but it's consistent with the Higgs. An effect called weak neutral currents. CERN also goes on to find proof that these W and Z particles exist, which are also completely consistent with the Higgs thing. Another group in Germany finds this gluon particle I was talking about earlier. Now, from the US side, they see Europe essentially getting very confident at particle physics. They're making hugely important discoveries, Nobel Prize-winning discoveries. They decide, a New York Times editorial put it really well. They said there is a need for earnest revenge. And what this meant was building an enormous particle collider that would basically not only blow out of the water CERN's then existing collider, which was a large electron-positron collider, which was a big machine in itself. It's the same size as the LHC, 27 kilometers around. It would also essentially render the LHC obsolete before it was built. And this machine was going to be enormous, more than 50 miles around. And it would have been, it would have run at 40 TeV, 20 TeV on 20 TeV. So this, to put that in context, that is it's more than three times as powerful as the LHC. And this was in the 80s that this was being put forward. Now, what Alvin Trivelpiece does, who's with the Department of Energy, he has to sell it to Ronald Reagan. And he walks in to the office with a very big easel and some big bits of paper, and he's written on it in very big letters because someone's told him that Ronald Reagan's eyesight isn't doing so well. And he takes him through, the very basics of particle physics, saying, look, this is what we do, this is how we do it. A particle accelerator is essentially a gun. One of the things we want to do is basically create an enormous gun. And he thought, on going into this meeting, he thought, well, I'm trying to sell something to Reagan, I'm trying to sell it to a lot of senators. One thing they all understand is guns. One thing they'll probably understand is any reference to kind of farmland life, ranch life, hay bales sounds good. So he said, look, he posed them this question. He said, say I have a load of billiard balls. I'm going to hide them in stacks of hay, pile them up. How do I find out where they are? How do I find out these big analogies of particles in these big hay bales? So he says, what you do is you get a gun and you fire at the hay bales and you try and see where the bullets go straight through. And you try and see where the bullets deflect. And by measuring the deflection of the bullets off the balls inside the hay bales that you can't see, you can infer something about the ball that's in there or the particle that he's trying to get this analogy of. Quite a weak analogy, actually. But he says if you start off with basically a crappy gun, a BB gun, your bullets will just get into the hay bale. You won't get any information. But if you get a really hardcore gun and fire it, you will get your results because you will probably, you will get your deflections off this big ball in the hay bale, but you'll probably smash it to pieces as well and get fragments coming out. And President Reagan, whether he loved it or not, it certainly worked. Reagan may well have decided before the meeting that he was going to fund this monster machine. He was very up for it. He may well have thought that it would help in Peter Higgs's phrase "zap the commies," he may have thought it would help in the sort of whole Cold War that was coming. But you know, that project ended up being probably the most ill-fated project of U.S. particle physics.
We're running out of time, and I did sort of want to talk about the story of how the LHC came about, but we all know it has. So we'll move on to...
it's definitely there.
It's definitely there.
It was good.
So what's happening? You know, what does the future hold? How confident are we that it's going to find...
There's some interesting politics and some interesting physics going on now, because you may have realized there was a particle physics meeting in Paris very recently where, although it was very much anticipated as the meeting, and correctly, that it was the first meeting that the LHC physicists would be presenting their first data, no one rightly expected them to have any meaningful results of new physics. It's too early. The machines don't work that way. But the US competitor, the Tevatron at Fermilab near Chicago, did come out, and there were some rumors before the meeting that they'd found the Higgs, which was pretty damn unlikely, because you just look at how much they need to do. It was unlikely. And sure enough, they hadn't found it. What they have done is, I was talking about, you need to narrow down the mass range where it is. They've done that a lot more. They basically ruled out a quarter of the mass range where it could be. Now, what's interesting is that the guys at the Tevatron are putting a plan together now that they're trying to get approved to run the Tevatron until 2014, which will take it... The LHC will run until the end of 2011 and then close down for 15 months and then start running at twice the energy. It's full energy only at some time in 2012. And so it does make this ongoing race still more, potentially more sort of neck and neck. I mean, the Tevatron is way out in front. It still has a chance, but they have to be lucky. The LHC people are confident, but again, they're looking at, it's going to be 2014 for them, I think, as well.
But, you know, we talk about it in terms of a race, but basically, you know, what we would like is for either of them to actually come up with some sort of positive results either way.
Yeah, I don't think really. I mean, the race is hyped up, and it is a reality that there is a race. But more than anything, you know, the physicists on both sides of the Atlantic say, look, we want to find it, and we don't care if someone else finds it, brilliant, because then we'll know some more physics, and it will probably be a door towards other things in physics that we don't know yet, and that is probably where things get really exciting.
Well, you've been listening to Little Atoms. We've been talking to Ian Sample about his book Massive, The Hunt for the God Particle, which is out now from Virgin Books. Ian, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Sure.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website at littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.